Okay. Right. The basic idea of most social theory is basically that order is normal and good. Since Adam Smith casually proposed the invisible hand, and it was in fact very casually, it wants in the whole of the wealth of nations. So it's quite interesting to see how that tiny metaphor suddenly became big. The tendency has been to assume that markets are self-organizing, adaptive, or in beneficial equilibrium, rather than self-disorganizing, disruptive, or prone to sterile equilibriums. Disruption is generally ignored in theory and made external, like new technology and information society theory, greed in liberal pro-capitalist political theory, or government regulation or unions in neoclassical economics. Even in Marxism, disorder ends with the triumph of the workers, and as Hodgson argues, Marx ignores impurities in capitalism, simplifying it into a self-contained, ideal-type two-class system. And these impurities, such as kin, family organisation, social trust and so on, are actually necessary for it to function at all. It is easy for us to think of spontaneous order, but less easy to think of spontaneous disorder. Social theory reduces complexity and chaos to an order which can be understood, and disorder is almost by definition the stuff we ignore or the stuff we are hostile to. This paper argues that the convergence of networks and information into situations of unpredictability and disorder and disruption is actually important, and attempts to open some of the paradoxes and incoherences that constitute the information society, making disorder central to its analysis. And not much of what I'm going to say is particularly original, it's just focusing on things that everybody knows about. So, taking Castells as an example of how networks are supposed to work, when he talks of networks, complexity is promoted, yet its effects are essentially denied. Networks are a product of computers in Castells. There is a networking logic, and the logic here is reassuring. The morphology of the network is supposed to absorb uncertainty and complexity, so we might think about the internet supposedly routing around accidents and so on. The benefits of the next network grow exponential. It grants flexibility, a good thing perhaps. Its processes are reversible. We hear the ability to reconfigure, which implies its safety. And as it says there, we can turn the rules upside down without destroying the organization. We can retool things. He talks of it as a highly integrated system, a convergence, growing convergence of specific technologies. The integrated here implies it's well coordinated, that shares logics of information generation. This treats information as simple and real, of course, something which I'll argue is not the case later on. The whole thing sounds robust and open to order and to knowledge. He also, as I say, there writes of self-organizing structures that create complexity out of simplicity and superior order out of chaos. And the superior order is important to Castell's argument. For instance, here he says it follows an unprecedented combination of flexibility and task implementation, a coordinated decision-making and decentralized execution, which provides a superior social morphology for human action. Therefore, we are living in the utopia, in case you didn't realize it. Networks are ordering. Castells is not alone in this. Other writers, while objecting to the idea that networks and information explain everything about modern society, talk of things like structural conditions, lattices, matrices, regular layout, the nervous system of our future society. There's a whole series of metaphors of linear coordination and being well tied together, used in the names of networks. Now, all this sounds relatively progressive and safe. The implication is networks are resilient and handle crises. In fact, Castells pushes crises to the edge of the networks, to Africa and places like that, which are outside the network. The theory is reassuringly normative and anticipates consistency. History might not be over, but everything will work out. Within this framework, disorder is entirely secondary. And yet, our own experience is probably not of this. Contemporary networks are often temporary and shifting. Links and nodes drop out, leading to separations and failures. There is no guarantee that interactive intentions will lead to the any result intended, especially if everybody tries to undermine each other. Think of your own networks and how they shade in and shade out and fall to pieces and so on, and are very temporary. Even if some strands are longer lasting, can we automatically assume that they are more important? Yet there is another side which needs more in consideration too. Computer networks, which are supposedly the basis of the network society according to Castells, regularly fail and are disordered by unexpected feedback. Some interviews I did with people suggest that this is actually quite common. For instance, one person who had previously worked in IT rescue suggested that for a major Australian business, and we're talking a really major Australian business here, which depends on computer networks, there would be on average 10 major disruptions per month and hundreds of minor disruptions. There were routine delays, unexpected costs, losses of service, data loss, data theft, information failure, overly complex processes, billing failures, strange bugs, software incompatibilities, threats from hackers, virus, cable breakers, stupidity, and so on. He even told a story about how somebody just walked into the mainframe room and pulled out the wrong plug. Did wonders for their system all day. Okay, even if systems have run for years, they can suddenly fail in catastrophic and public ways. Probably even more fail and get kept quiet, because I'm quite sure that most of you don't know that this particular company has 10 major breakdowns a month. Networks have to be reassembled regularly. Now, this is quite well known. This is a quote from Sarin in the Computer Weekly of a survey of 450 IT directors across the UK, Germany and France. 73% say they have major faults in their IT systems. Lack of quality in software has a direct impact on the business. 36% report IT failures with considerable reduction in turnover. 43% said poor software quality led to a substantial drop in staff productivity, and so on. It's a more recent article going through web surveys. 26 to 34% of IT projects fail. So, software. So there's not only ongoing disruptions, but new projects frequently do not work or do not work adequately, and upgrades are frequent in case you thought they were working. I lost my email for 2 days last week while I was trying to organise all of this. Great fun. Anyway, so software disrupts work, changes work practices, and leads to constant retraining. We learn one program only to have another fostered on us, and that could lead to our dismissal or to the downgrading of work. In one place where the person I interviewed insisted that they always did their software installations perfectly and there was never a problem, he later talked about how everybody was suffering from change fatigue anyway, and that how these perfect software installations had meant that parts of the company which used to talk to each other all the time no longer could. Okay, the workplace is a site of continual conflict between management, IT, workers, different kinds of workers, different types of management, and so on. It is made disorderly and complex by the fact that there is no class unity. There is separation by position in the company, position whether you're here or external to the company, whether you're a contractor or whatnot. Essentially, competition is internally directed as much as externally within the capitalist organisation. And that perhaps that destroys the possibility of cooperation. And of course, you've also got to think of how often you might be restructured. I probably don't have to tell anybody about that at UTS. If there is a community at work, it is a community in the face of trauma. Software, power struggles, disruption, and uncertainty meet in the heart of the corporation and cannot be smoothed away. Experience of disorder is part of the system, it's not extraneous to it. An analysis which ignores the disorder is ignoring a fundamental part of the way the system works. However, I'm going to talk a bit about the financial crisis. Despite evidence of failure or disruption in the software, hardware, and power relations that keep the information society going, the current economic crisis arises not so much from the failure of networks and software, but from their success. That is, the success in extending the totalizing frameworks of information capitalism and revealing its paradoxes, incoherences, and inabilities. Okay, so I'm going to look here at information disruption from the role of taking models of reality, from the vagueness of boundaries in networks, which previously allowed control and no longer did, and from the structure of the workplace. I'm going to ignore an awful lot of things. like the internal incoherence of money, the appropriation of value from the functional system. I think it was Tony who was talking about, or was it Jeremy, talking about how, you know, only a tiny proportion of the actual economy is now actually geared towards production, and that 98% of it or so on is geared towards financial speculation. The cultivation of volatility for profit, separation of incomes, which means that people no longer relate to each other, and so on. They are important, but I'm not talking about them. Okay. The computers also allow the creation of complex, unstable networks that ricochet off each other, give too much data for humans to process, and in the continual crisis, people tend to take the models as reality. So it is widely believed that computer models created wealth out of nowhere. In this case, I'm talking about what people have said, not necessarily what's the truth, but the kind of visions that people have of disorder here. And it's widely believed that computer models created wealth out of nowhere via economic models that were inaccurate. This is from an article by Hansel in the New York Times, and he said that he discussed it with risk managers, and as you can see, that basically they considered that financial distress was extremely rare. If you, as I said earlier, talking to Tony, about every 3 to 5 years you get a major financial crisis, so this is quite extraordinary. Models ignored the possibilities of catastrophe, and according to these risk managers, overly buoyant assumptions were made, and the resulting models were fed with unreliable data. As one person who commented on this article, and I'm using a lot of articles that were blogged in this text, this, it's kind of like thinking that there's no chance your house will burn down because it hasn't burnt down yet. Model makers either did not consider previous crises or did not think that they were likely to reoccur. The expectation was that markets were ordered and that data was given to confirm this supposition. An ordered but fictive world was constructed to match business requirements. Models simplified, and the managerial demand was for further simplification. These simplifications hid extreme complexity behind apparently simple numbers. Okay, so they reduced the whole of massive complex things to one number. And this allowed them to ignore the complex interconnections or the facts about the actual debt or safety of the items and just take it down in that single number. The only thing that matters is the final correlation number, as it's called. One clean, simple, all-sufficient figure that sums up everything. As a result, just about anything could be bundled and turned into AAA bond corporate bank loan. Basically, everything could be made to look like a AAA credit rating thing, whether it was or not. Commentators suggest that in fact, people thought that they may have been able to take more risks than they would have been normally able to do because the computers successfully calculated the risks and thus insured them from bad results. And this is a common result of that's come out of accident theory, is the safer that you make something, the more extreme the risks that people will take with it. Taking models for reality also meant that ratings agencies' ratings were taken as real rather than fallible guesses, something furthered by the urge to sell these debts to others. In fact, so what the impetus was to turn the debts into a number and then get rid of them to somebody else via the ratings agency's certification. Now, the ratings agencies certified or approved the models which allowed the gathering of possibly bad mortgages and derivatives into highly rated assets, and they were paid by the companies whose products they rated. So the control boundaries were actually broken within the networks. Banks used their names, essentially a magic seal of approval, if you like, on these credit ratings to sell bad loans to other investors. Presumably the idea was to let those investors bear the risk rather than the banks. However, in a network, it all circles round because of the network multiple connections and linkages between firms. So eventually, you couldn't actually transfer the bad debts to somebody else. They came back to you. So the boundaries were broken by the networks and thus undermined the trust which allowed the system to work in the first place. But there was quite a lot of people who were blogging on this suggested that there was in fact opposition to the models, but it was hard to express. People essentially have to follow orders. This is one quote from a programmer, basically saying that the computer code that he had to was given was shit, but nevertheless he had to do what he was told to do. They would put people like us, IT people, under extraordinary pressure to try and do things that were impossible. We were never given the proper time to vet the work they had done or to try and understand the nuances of what their models and trading strategies were. There was always significant pressure to come up with the right results, but the time wasn't there. Another programmer writes similarly, I eventually got tired of telling clients about the range of validity and limitations of the models, because everybody either wanted to just get a number at the bottom of a printout they could follow, or to tweak the assumptions until the output matched their hunch. Bloggers almost overwhelmingly thought that within their experience, managers liked inaccurate models as they helped make money in the short term. Finding risk might hinder sales. Hansel himself required that as regulators required people to monitor and report risks, there was an incentive for them not to find any. And this was in fact agreed to by a guy called Greg Berman, who was the co-head of risk management at a company called RiskMetrics, who said that the systems were designed not to pick up risks so the firm's capital base could remain stable and the limits they imposed on their trading desks and portfolio managers would be stable. In other words, they tried to impose order on a chaotic system and therefore made it more chaotic. Another blogger writes, I have personally seen CFOs, chief financial officers, stand late nights arguing with the risk analyses to make default ratio assumptions more optimistic just before a loan is securitized and sold off. As I said earlier, they turn these debts into a number and sell them to somebody else. Another person argued that he actually had done financial models, but it didn't matter how good his models were if he was given crap data by others. And many people sort of did the old garbage in, garbage out slogan when talking about this. One person wrote, computers produce faster and more efficiently the errors that once took a lot of work. Okay, so basically the hierarchy of the firm and the system of rewards and punishments did not reward caution or the communication of pessimism. Information was trimmed to get the right result, and that is what guarantees that it is the right information, that it tells you what you already want to know. So another programmer wrote, anyone who keeps arguing soon gets the label of being difficult and not a tame player, or worse, does not understand the business. Labels which are a death knell to a career. Other writers implied that you would easily get fired or demoted if you did not give people the results they wanted, even if those results were false. One person stated, well, the problem was that those with the grey hair or risk management savvy were all fired for questioning the business model. And in fact, I read also that Citibank, for instance, sacked their whole risk department slightly before this crash happened because they were giving them the wrong information, like they were telling them this was dangerous and stupid. Banks were said not to be interested in risk management as they see it only as a cost centre and as a pain in the arse. It does not make money, so therefore it's useless. Now, this might seem a bit extreme, but there's an awful lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that this is the case. A guy called Michelson wrote an autobiography of his time in Countrywide, which is a major loan provider in the States. And even though he was a high-level management figure, he conveys the sense in his book, and obviously his book is written to save himself as well as anything else. He can't trust it necessarily, but he implies that basically all the decisions were already made, and even when he was objecting that, you know, you couldn't keep assuming that house prices would keep going up and up and up and up forever, they would just say that they've run the numbers and the risk is offset by the opportunity for market share and revenue gain. Shut up. And it was consistent with the company's mission, which was, of course, to make lots of money. So basically, there was no room for dissent at all within this thing. So it seems generally agreed upon that there was no possibility of open communication within the corporation, and that to communicate any accurate information which went against immediate profit or desire of management would be seen as failings in the reporter. Okay, the standard comment here is that good communication only occurs between equals, so consequently corporations are always doomed. Now, my interviews have also tell of this, again, reinforced this whole thing. They told supervisors who never talked to each other, competing departments in different countries who block the flow of information and work, managers who go in fear of other managers who don't know what's going on, or who hide their ignorance and impenetrability so that you don't know what's going on either. They blame each other. Reports of malfunction were considered as obstruction. Basically, success was always made a great deal of, and failure so that was always played down. So consequently, negative feedback never got back into the managerial system at all. So those at the top never knew what was happening. And furthermore, a constant refrain of all the ethnographies and interviews is that basically everybody is tired, absolutely exhausted continually. So they're in a state of permanent confusion. And there was an article in the Herald basically saying that nowadays most people work a 10 to 12 hour day in Australian business and maybe have one day a week off, and they're so exhausted during that day they only just manage to get back. Okay, there's also the inequality issue means that, in fact, if you do make it successfully for even a year or so, you can probably retire for the rest of your life. Okay, now most people in banks and so on get crap wages as well, like everybody else. But nevertheless, there is always that incentive to put yourself in that, going along with all this, so you can, in fact, retire forever. And also, there's a part of the rhetoric of how do you show that your company is good? And you show your company is good by being inside whatever is the big market at that moment. And if you're not inside that big market at the moment, you are automatically telling other people that you're in a position of weakness and on the way out. And therefore your share price will crash. So there is incentive all along time to get into risky and uncertain positions. Okay, furthermore, when information becomes the chief commodity, then spreading misinformation or withholding information is vital. So the paradox is that the information society requires free spread of information in order to work smoothly. But at every stage, the pressure is there to wall off information or to distort information for profit, power, or advantage. Bad data was used to make results look better, to sell proposed behaviour, and to continue short-term money-making. Presentation of bad but favourable data was common at all points in the hierarchy of business as it was rewarded. Computerisation essentially became a form of magic, giving the appearance of control and safety. Okay, so basically networks are not sharply bounded and self-driven. They can be messy, sometimes disordered, disordering and self-destructive. Boundaries are fuzzy and different systems overlap and affect each other significantly and undermine each other. There is no possibility of decoupling of the sort that Tony was talking was I was high in theory. In fact, having networks add extra couples all along the way, so that different effects in one area cascade through all sorts of stuff. People are caught up in systems which organise and disorganise them and their activities, especially when these partial systems are such that they are taken as being the whole. So in conclusion, Okay, networks break control boundaries, they make simplifications which get taken as real because people act on them. I mean, these people do act on the models, so the models become the reality, okay? And the models always have the biases of the programming to start with, so they feed back on them, becoming more and more inaccurate as they go along. They encourage the use of bad data to make those models work, because you want those models to work, and if you prove that they don't work, then you're in trouble. And you also need to be able to sell the products of those models, which in this case was the debt structures. So you need to make those models look as if they're going to work. It makes distortion part of the system. Speed is another part of the system, which I didn't actually get to talk about, but that adds, you make money out of speed. Slight variations in, say, currency prices can generate huge amounts of money before they adjust back. Okay, as you do the loop, say from US dollars to Australian dollars to something else, and you make a permanent increase in that until somebody else finds it. So you've got to be really, really fast. So that means all the time you're out of control. Breaking communication and making rivalries, social conflict and uncertainty central to the functions of the workplace, which also undermines any sense of easy organisation. So it extends the dynamics of capitalism, competition and so on, where they become destructive to capitalism and undermine it in its ability to survive. So I would say network society is disordered by networks, the information society is disordered by information, and management society is disordered by managers. Yes.
I think that was really cool. I really enjoyed that. But I think mine's probably more of a comment, and it's a shame Jeremy's not here. But
yeah.
For me, you've just created the argument of why we shouldn't marketize the environment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed. In fact, one of Jeremy's arguments in an earlier paper that he made was that in fact financializing the environment adds financial crisis to environmental crisis and just magnifies the effect. And that in fact, you get all these distortions of trade would then distort things that were happening to the environment because people would manipulate.
And also that the other way, wouldn't it? Because you don't want to report that the part of the environment that you own in that
absolutely,
energy
absolutely.
To share because
yeah.
that would reduce.
Yeah. And as they also said, as Jeremy also said earlier, you get the situation where you do as much polluting as you possibly can now so that you can get credit for it when you stop doing it. So
aren't you making a big argument then? You're not just talking about markets as being irrational and disorderly. Yes, you're talking also about bureaucracies.
Yep.
As being irrational and disorderly. So this applies to any social formation.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
And therefore,
markets intensify it a bit because of the
stress. And also, in computers intensify because of the stress.
Yeah.
So, taking disorder seriously requires you to
this is the problem in a way, and it requires. I think it requires you to have a new kind of social analysis. And I haven't quite got to what the heart of it, a disorderly social analysis, but that's actually orderly. I mean, because you say, oh, look, I can't say anything about it, it's too bloody complex. And that's not much of an analysis, really. So, but
lots of people do that.
But then they say, oh, well, we leave it alone, like with the finance market. So it's complicated, so we leave it alone, we leave it to the financiers. I don't know if that's particularly good argument, but I think what it does do for me at the moment is that it makes, instead of trying to simplify things all the time, which is what I did previously, making social structures and all that sort of stuff, is that you look at all the bits around that, all the fuzzy edges and stuff, which I think is actually quite important, that sometimes things work precisely because they're not actually structured as neatly as you might think, and all the disorderly bits are actually vital parts of the culture and so on. But I think that, I mean, there's a sort of Taoism here as well, in the sense that you can't have an abstract plan, I think, and then try and force reality to the abstract plan. You've got to sort of flow with it. So it requires a sort of different set of metaphors as to how you operate. But yes, I've no idea as to what the kind of social theory will look like. All is that I suspect is that it will show that a lot of things that we thought were unimportant or negligible are actually quite important. And one of the interesting things that I've found is there's actually quite a lot of managerial writing about bad management, but it's never taken into management theory. It's always, oh, we know Parkinson's law, we know the Peter principle, but we can forget them. Or it doesn't happen anymore. It's just like crises in economics, We have crises every other week, but we don't actually have to think about them. And I think once you make the crises and the disorder a central part of your project, then you can no longer just ignore those in terms of your ideal types about how everything should work. Yeah.
One of the things you said really struck me as well, though, was that, part of the problem you were saying was that they kept telling everybody it's all good. And, complexity theory tells us that you also have to have negative feedback loops.
Absolutely.
So you Absolutely. Acknowledge the negative feedback. Yeah. So even something very simple like that, by saying, okay, report the bad news.
Tell us
what the real situation is. Like, corporate reporting's totally misconstrued, the whole lot of it, because they just produce a report that tells the shareholders that everything's going well here. Thank you. Please give us more money.
Yeah, I mean, Barbara Ehrenbach, I think, recently just published a book which claims that positive thinking is the bane of the American capitalism, because the whole point is that, you know, you must think positively, so therefore negative feedback, that's a failure, you know?
Yeah.
You can't have that. You've got to go forth and conquer and do it properly, you know? I agree. Certainly, negative feedback is vitally important. You know, you have it's... It's one of those things that in fact, you know, there used to be an old saying, what, you know, fail once, fail again, better, or something like that, you know, that in fact that you actually come to a successful point through a whole series of failures. Mm-hmm. But that's also ingrained in the particular kind of hierarchy of capitalism, that basically your job position is usually so precarious that you can't give negative feedback.
Mm.
Or even in the university, that some of you gave negative feedback on some restructuring process, you probably wouldn't get very far with it. You know, people wouldn't be able to hear you. They would think you weren't going along with something. You were being, you know, obstructive.
Not a team player.
Mm.
Yeah, not a team player. But, you know, I mean... Again, a good team player is a person who actually points out where things are going wrong and puts forward a solution. Doesn't say, you know, you're wrong, that's the end of it. You put forward a solution.
Like, my job is I manage student complaints for one of the universities. The thing is, the entire framework is about how actually complaints are good, because that is how you solve problems, and I would say at an abstract level, the management is absolutely committed to that. But day to day, the question is, how can you flick that or get rid of that, because there's not enough time to deal with it adequately, and there's more important things to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a campus of 30,000 students, and there is one person who does student complaints.
Well, I think that's the answer, isn't it?
Or student misconduct.
Yeah.
Now, so, generally, what does it matter, actually, if management does accept those things about complaints? And, look, I would say that's pretty accepted in major corporations and in... But the resourcing of that process...
I would say in any kind of institution, if it's not resourced, it's not valued. Doesn't matter what they say.
You're a cost.
I think the real answer here is that this is obviously part of the project. Maybe the obvious answer here is to create a consultancy, management disorder consultants or something like that, where John can go in and, you know, advise.
Advise
this university, this nameless university.
Okay, you just pay me a couple of $100,000.
I was just wondering, John, we were thinking over the last few years about networks and disorder and the productive aspect of it. And, you know, there's that visual schema or schemata of, you know, representing networks that we all know, the dots and the lines. And I think even on Castell, one of his books, you know, that's sort of the image on the book. So I'm wondering if things are coming up for you just in terms of new kind of visual schemata for networks that kind of represent some of this fuzziness and the disorderliness, but the productiveness.
Well,
it's very different from that.
I mean, what I'm sort of playing with in the talk I give later in the week is the old feminist metaphor of weaving, but I'm actually interested in the discards. You know, if you've got a loom, you end up with what they call a thrum on the end, which is the bit you chuck away, which allows the actual pattern to exist. So I'm thinking of a network in terms of its discards. Okay, in terms of its thrum, its fringed edges, the knots on the back. The possibility of unravelling by just cutting the wrong knot or whatever, or the knot getting pulled and everything being changed in its shape and so on.
Can you put that into a computer program and model it?
I have no idea. But I'm sort of technophobic enough not to want to put it in.
Yeah, that's what those
different
programs in
social movement theory to map social movement networks that are disordered.
What it attracts your attention towards is the shifting and fading nature of networks, the way that things drop out and get distorted and so on.
But wouldn't you want to look at the little box?
But that's the point, is that once you would get your abstracted shapes, which are not at all, it's all hostile to the invincible. But you then look at all the other bits as well. You say, okay, I've got this simplification, but what else? I mean, remember, it's a simplification. What else there in the mess is
sure
actually keeping
that
going together?
You'll be looking for patterns.
Of course, you're just human. You can't avoid that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, all I would say is don't try and reduce the mess totally to order. You know, construct an ideal type or whatever it is and then just chuck everything else away. You can never get to the total mess, but yeah,
shall
you can try.
Shall we leave mess behind? And
yes, absolutely. And find marks.
And then we've got marks.
Just look at marks instead of mess.